may be around the world, and thank you for your company on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letteru.org. Joining me is the Director of Education and Counseling for Jews for Judaism in Canada. The website is jewsforjudaism.ca. That's jewsforjudaism.ca. Welcome back to the program, Rabbi Michael Skoback.
Shalom, Jono, from the Great White North.
Hello, my friend. So now we are, of course, we're continuing along. We're investigating the alleged 365 messianic prophecies in the Tanakh that Jesus supposedly fulfilled in the New Testament. But we've had some interesting developments in the past couple of weeks, haven't we?
Yeah, we lost some weight, I think.
We did lose some weight, and we've been streamlined a little bit. What happened was, and we owe a thank you to former Truth to You critic, Carmen Welker. Now, I say former Truth to You critic. Unfortunately, she's not the critic anymore of Truth to You. She's resigned from that position. We've become quite friendly on emails going back and forth, and we've been discussing things, and she's been very helpful. And she did go through the list. In fact, I'd like to read to you what she wrote, because she left a comment last week. It goes like this. She said, "Shalom, Jono. At the risk of being verbally beaten to death by your listeners," that's the way she begins, so I'm just going to say to all the listeners, please don't verbally beat to death Carmen, okay? Carmen Welker of the refinersfire.org, is it? Let me just say, therefinersfire.org. Yeah, that's her website. Nobody beat Carmen to death. Now, she said, "At the risk of being verbally beaten to death by your listeners, I'm going to post this anyway. Since your refutation of those messianic prophecies were kicked off by a list you found on our website, The Refiner's Fire, we have gone through all the 365 prophecies ourselves and realized that there were definitely some problems with it." Now, before I continue, I should just point out, Carmen, we actually didn't find... When you and I, Michael, started the 365, we weren't looking at the Refiner's Fire.
No, I think we were using another one.
We were using another one, but it happened to be the same list, and we were well into the list when Carmen decided that she wanted to put her hand up to be the official Truth to You critic. And when I saw that she had the same list on her website, I can't lie, I did have a little bit of a chuckle, and I thought, well, this is too good to be true. We better start using her list. But she says that she did go through it. There were definitely some problems with it, she says. The full list, which originally contained 365 entries, had many citations which were improperly cited or could be considered duplicate because they pointed to the same messianic connection but different verses, she says. Though a count of prophecies is not important, she says, these errors and duplications did not seem right to include, so they were corrected and removed. Now she has an updated list. I'll put a link to that so people can see it. And she says, we accept, and this is big of her, I think. She writes, "We accept that instead of just copying it from some other website and believing it to be correct, we should have done due diligence on the list in the first place." And I think that's good. I think Carmen's, it's big of her to admit that. And she has refined, if you like. This is what you call... what did you call this new list?
The New Revised Standard Version.
This is the New Revised Standard Version. Instead of 365, I think now we have 302.
Okay.
So she managed to trim 63 from her list, and that's commendable, I suppose. Now, when her and I discussed this, she told me she was going to go through the list. I said to her, what might be a handy thing is at the top of your list, if you tell the readers the rules of hermeneutics that you use in order to qualify something as a prophecy, I think that would be beneficial. And she said, that's a great idea. That's what I'll do. Now, there is an explanation at the top of her list, but it's not so much about the rules of hermeneutics as to how she qualifies a prophecy. What she says is, while not everything in this list can be described as a, quote, prophecy, the narrative in the Tanakh is astoundingly rich in connections between what was revealed hundreds and thousands of years before the Messiah and the actions and words of Messiah Yeshua, which were captured in the Brit Hadashah, the New Testament. I want to go back to that word connections. While she says that while not everything in this list can be described as a prophecy, it's astoundingly rich in connections. So really what this list has become is 362 prophecies and connections, which reminds me of apophenia. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Apophenia is the experience of seeing patterns or connections in random or meaningless data, which is, you know, Michael, when people see, they look at clouds and they go, oh, that looks like a butterfly, or that looks like a face, or that looks like whatever.
Like a Rorschach test.
There you go. Exactly like that. Or when the toast pops up and there's the face of Jesus in your toast. Everyone's seen that on the internet. That is pareidolia. And apophenia is a similar thing, but it's within a body of text. You see connections. And so I guess what Carmen is saying is that this new list of 302 is what she considers to be some to be prophecy. And I guess that's probably the 48 that she has. Remember, she had the list of 48, which were the real solid. They were the rock solid ones. And now the 302, I guess the rest of those must be connections. Thoughts?
Well, I think that I would agree with her. And I think that just in terms of process, what's important to appreciate is that this idea of connections means that the person making the list begins with their belief that Jesus was the Messiah. And beginning at that point, they then find connections to what they see as words or narratives or what have you in the Hebrew scriptures, and they make the connection. And that I can appreciate, doing. I think that, you can really start off with anything and find connections to a document as large as the Hebrew scriptures.
Hmm.
But the real question is, why begin at that point? Meaning, if there aren't clear prophecies that identify Jesus as the Messiah, so why begin this entire enterprise of finding connections to him? Meaning, I think that the critical question is, do the Hebrew scriptures contain clear evidence that identify Jesus as the Messiah? Now, if that is the case, if it's clearly established that he is the Messiah, then it would be worthwhile to say, well, you see, now that we know this with clarity, we can actually find many, many connections and references and clouds and types and, hints. Hmm. And, that would be, I think, a worthwhile project. The real question is, do we really have that? Meaning, do we really have, now I guess she would say that with these 48, you can build that kind of strong case, and we'll have to make sure we address those.
Hmm.
But I think that this idea of finding connections, if we really appreciate what it's doing, is it's really beginning at a point of belief. It begins with the belief that Jesus is the Messiah, and then from there, they go back to the Hebrew scriptures and find what they see as connections or things that sound, that resonate with that belief in Jesus. Now, that's really what I would question. Is that belief in Jesus something that can be linked to the Hebrew scriptures? Meaning that the Hebrew scriptures actually justify that belief that he was the Messiah.
That's the question.
Yeah.
That's the question. And let me say again, this is something that certainly Carmen believes is valid. This is a valid way of reading the scriptures. To her, she finds meaning in these connections, and she thinks that this is the way that her scriptures are supposed to fit together. And when I say her scriptures, of course, it's the Tanakh plus the New Testament, as she says. And look, she has every right to practice that. And I just want to remind the listeners, we respect the right of others to express and evangelize their religion. We're not anti-missionary. We don't want to shoot down everybody for opening their mouth just because they don't think like us. But we would like to look at those claims and counter them. Why? Because they use our book to do it. I think that's fair enough.
That's important. That's important because what it does boil down to is that her project, or not just her, but the Christian enterprise gets off the ground with the axiom. It's an axiom that for them the Bible is both the Greek scriptures and the Hebrew scriptures, and therefore really what it comes down to at the end of the day is that the New Testament just makes the claim that Jesus was the Messiah, and that's all they really need, meaning that once their Bible states unequivocally that he was the Messiah, that becomes a fact. That becomes fact on the ground. And mm-hmm. So once that's established, once that stake has been put into the ground, then of course you would expect that the Old Testament as well would have connections and types and clouds and shadows and allusions and hints, etc., to what the Christian Bible has already established. And I agree that, that's certainly a valid thing to do for a person who accepts the Christian scriptures axiomatically as part of their spiritual point of reference. But what happens, and it's important to remember this, is that the Christian witness to the Jewish people appreciates that the Jewish people, at least, and maybe others as well, but Jewish people don't begin with the acceptance of the Greek scriptures as part of their Bible. And so the Christian appreciates that at the end of the day, despite what they believe, they have to make the case from the Old Testament itself. And so here is where the problem comes up. I appreciate that it's possible to go from the New Testament back to the Old Testament and find connections and hints and clouds and types and etc. The question that we're exploring is, but can you go from the Hebrew Scriptures to the New Testament? Meaning, just based upon the data, the Scriptures in Hebrew, does that contain enough information to make a slam dunk case for the Messiahship of Jesus?
That's right. So so I think what we will do, because Carmen has been good enough to go through the list in its entirety and she has trimmed it down to 302, I don't see a reason for us to address the ones that she has omitted. Do you think that's fair?
I think it's fair, and I think this way we have a chance of finishing before the year 2016.
Okay. So now on the original list, we were up to number 164. On the New Revised Standard, Carmen's New Revised Standard list, we're now up to 113 of the list of 302. That, of course, is Isaiah chapter, or Isaiah, as you guys say over there, Isaiah chapter 7:14, which is very timely. This can be our Christmas special. Michael, what do you think?
Let's go for it.
Isaiah chapter 7:14, it says, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son." Now, in my New King James, it has son capitalized with capital S. "Will bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel." Now, the corresponding verse to this in the New Testament, according to the list, the New Standard Revised list, is Luke chapter 1, verse 35. It says, "And the angel answered and said to her, the Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Highest will overshadow you. Therefore, also, that Holy One who is to be born will be called the Son of God." And the messianic prophecy fulfilled, according to the list, is to be born of a young woman. Oh, look at this. It says to be born of a young woman / virgin, and in brackets, Alma. Thoughts?
Okay. You know, it's interesting that this really, although for some reason they give the reference here to Luke chapter 1, I would have expected the more reasonable reference would have been to Matthew chapter 1, which actually quotes Isaiah chapter 7. I don't think that Luke mentions Isaiah chapter 7. Even though scholars question whether Matthew was actually the first of the Gospels written, most people think that Mark came first, Matthew maybe 10 years later. But at least in the text that we have, Matthew was the first book in the Christian scriptures. And Matthew chapter 1 being the first chapter, this is really the first. Isaiah chapter 7 is the first of the so-called fulfillment texts in the New Testament, meaning that, especially in the book of Matthew, Matthew has quite a few passages where the formula is that Jesus fulfilled that which was written in the Hebrew Scriptures. And this is the first one. So I think it's significant that the very first time the New Testament cites a verse from the Hebrew Bible claiming that it's a messianic prophecy fulfilled by Jesus is this passage in Isaiah. And I think, unfortunately for them, it gets off to a very bad start, meaning I think that we're going to see that Matthew gets this passage in Isaiah so wrong and in so many ways that I think it becomes an embarrassment for Christians. And I think that's why what we're seeing, I think, over the last few decades is that many missionary groups and enterprises really no longer trumpet this passage
in Isaiah. They're shying away from it. Yeah. They're shying away from it. Now it's fair, because the next one on the list, in the New Revised Standard list, she does list here Matthew chapter 1, verse 22, in reference to the prophecy that he is to be called Emmanuel, God with us. Now, it's I will read it. Let me just read it, because it says, all of this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, behold, the virgin shall be with child, the virgin shall be with child, and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated is God with us. And it goes on to say that then Joseph, being aroused from sleep, did as the angel of the Lord commanded him, and took to him his wife Mary. He did not know her until she had brought forth her firstborn son, and they called his name Jesus. Now, of course, we've already discussed that his name isn't Jesus, it's actually Yeshua, but it's not Emmanuel. Now, it's interesting that you should say that the Christian endeavor is shying away from this one. If I may, can I read you what it says? I've got a little study note in my New King James. Would you like to know what it says?
I'm curious.
It has a little in-depth study, and this is it's very telling, I think. It says, Emmanuel. It says, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, end quote. During the Christmas season, Michael, it says, this verse becomes part of our common vocabulary, Christian common vocabulary. Most Christmas pageants recite this verse, and pastors explain the meaning of Emmanuel, God with us. How the prophecy was fulfilled in the birth of Christ is recorded in the Gospel of Matthew, as you just pointed out, but there are still questions that surround this prophecy. For instance, how could the birth of Jesus be assigned to Ahaz? Sometimes unraveling biblical prophecy can be difficult, it says. It goes on to say, this is one of those cases. Christians have interpreted this prophecy in several different ways. Some have thought that the anonymous, quote, virgin may refer to a royal mother, more specifically, Ahaz's wife. Thus, the child would be Hezekiah, Ahaz's successor. Hezekiah would be a sign to Ahaz that God was in control. The Lord was with Ahaz. He would be saved. He would save Judah from the enemies that surrounded Ahaz, enabling his son to inherit the throne. Others have identified Isaiah's wife, the prophetess of chapter 8, verse 3, as the virgin. It says, she was a young woman of marriageable age, another meaning of the Hebrew word translated as virgin. They admit this, Michael. They're going to say the child in this case would be the son of Isaiah, and his name would be Emmanuel, meaning God with us, to symbolize judgment and salvation. It says, in fact, Isaiah himself described this his children as signs to the nation in chapter 8, verse 18. And he delivered a similar prophecy for his son. It says, compare chapter 7, 16 with chapter 8, verse 4. The third look at this, in this little mini study here in my New King James Study Bible, it says, some cite that the parable between the prophecy that, quote, a virgin shall conceive, and Jesus' miraculous birth as evidence that this prophecy was fulfilled only in Jesus, they say that this is the only way of looking at it. It says, Mary was the virgin mother, and the birth of Jesus was a sign of God's salvation. His name would be Emmanuel, God with us, because Jesus was the Son of God, and he lived among us. According to this view, Isaiah's prophecy had no fulfillment prior to Jesus' birth. It's not uncommon for biblical prophecies to have one level of fulfillment in the immediate future and one final fulfillment many years later in the person and work of the Savior Jesus. Thus, the pregnancy of Isaiah's new wife and the birth of her son could have been assigned to Ahaz. However, this would have been a fulfillment, not the fulfillment. And this is the way that they see it. And they finish it by saying, the prophecy was completely fulfilled in the coming of God's only Son to the earth. He is the only child who can truly be called Wonderful Counselor, Prince of Peace. Now, that's chapter 9, verse 6, and we will be getting there. But there's three views, and they do admit that it's problematic, and they leave it to the reader, I suppose, to decide which one they want to go with.
And I think that's honest of them, and I think that's...
It's fairly honest.
Yeah, and I think that what it illustrates is something that we've brought up before, which is that what it immediately does is it removes this passage in Isaiah from what you could call proof or evidence. Meaning that, again, we have to appreciate that the whole enterprise here of this list, the people that compiled the list, are trying to say that the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, contains proof, evidence, mm-hmm. that Jesus was the Messiah. And that only works. You're only able to lay claim to have real evidence or proof when what you're presenting is clear and unambiguous. And the fact here that this commentary is really struggling with passage in Isaiah, and it's pretty clear to me that, you know, they seem to feel that on the simplest level of reading it, their interpretations number one and two make the most sense, mm-hmm. and yet they're sort of stuck with the interpretation of Matthew and Luke, and so they have to somehow come up with some way of squaring what is a difficult text in Isaiah with the Christian doctrine of the virgin birth. And that's their third footnote. Although I was confused by what you read, because at first they started saying that this third point of view insists that there was no fulfillment of this passage at the time of Isaiah, and it only became fulfilled later on with the birth of Jesus. But then they go back and they seem to say that actually there was a double fulfillment. They are clearly struggling with this passage because of the tremendous difficulties it presents. And again, all that our readers would have to, our listeners would have to do, is compare this again to a pristine, clear, unequivocal Old Testament prophecy that's really non-disputable about the Messiah, and just see the nature of the difference between what is clearly a passage describing the person of the Messiah, like we'll get to, God willing, next time we meet, Isaiah chapter 11, which all Jews and all Christians agree. Is about the Messiah, and because it's so clear. And this passage, which you can only really... it's almost like trying to force a square peg into a round hole. You can only do that by applying a lot of spin and a lot of twisting and a lot of grease, and it, even then it doesn't really fit in that well. What I found fascinating here, I mean, I may not understand the Greek scriptures that well, but I found Luke chapter 1, which is the verse, the cross-reference that's cited here, interesting, because in the story that's told, basically Mary is told that she is going to conceive and she's going to give birth to this child. She's not told in the script, in Luke, if you look at the text carefully, that she is pregnant. The angel doesn't tell her she is pregnant. The angel says that you will conceive a child. And she objects at that point by saying, but how is that possible? I have known no man. I'm a virgin. Now, to me, that's a little bizarre, because the fact that she's a virgin at this point doesn't preclude the possibility of, at some later point, becoming pregnant and having a child. So I just found the tie-in between this very first reference in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, to the birth of a child to a young woman slash virgin, connecting that to Luke, to me is strange, because the story in Luke, it doesn't really read simply. It doesn't read smoothly, because it's...
I have to admit, I had not noticed that before. So what you're saying that is, in Luke, the angel is speaking to Mary saying, this is what's going to happen. You're going to conceive, yes, though you have not been with a man. But in Matthew, that's not the case. In Matthew, the angel's talking to Joseph and saying, your wife is with child, and it is conceived by God. Is that...
Yeah, and the problem in Luke is that her objection is sort of doesn't mean anything. I mean, what does it mean? You know, if a woman who has never been with a man is told by an angel, look, you're going to, in the future, conceive and have a child, you wouldn't object to that. You wouldn't say, that's impossible, I'm a virgin. Being a virgin is irrelevant, because that doesn't preclude the possibility that she some later sure. point will have sexual relations and then become pregnant. So what I'd like to do, you know, given that this could be a huge project to grow through Isaiah chapter 7, is maybe just outline a few of the, I think, salient points. First of all, let's think about what claim is being made here. Meaning, okay, if we try to really penetrate, what is what's the point of this whole prophecy? Why is this coming up on the list? And it seems that what the list maker is saying, and I think what Matthew and Luke are saying, is that the Old Testament provided a prophecy, a sign, and that's what Isaiah uses, the word sign, a sign that would help identify the Messiah. That seems to be the whole purpose of the virgin birth story. Mm-hmm. And the question would be, would a virgin birth really function as a sign? What's significant, and I once did this as a project, is if you go through every single reference in the Hebrew Bible to the word sign, ot, what you see is that signs do not have to be supernatural, but signs are always visible. Matter of fact, the only time signs in the Bible are supernatural, the only stories where they are supernatural is in the plagues of Egypt. Mm-hmm. But aside from those stories, every other case in the Bible of a sign, it's not supernatural, but it's always visible. It has to be something that you can see. And it's quite clear that a virgin birth could never function as a sign, because you couldn't, for example, see Mary wheeling a baby carriage 2,000 years ago down the streets of Bethlehem and look at the little child and say, well, he's obviously the Messiah, this child, because I can tell that Mary is a virgin. That Mary did not walk around with a board-certified gynecological examination sticker on her clothing telling everyone she was a virgin. You can't tell. And so it's clear that a virgin birth is just absurd. Even her own fiancé, when Joseph, who wasn't actually married to her, and back then 2,000 years ago, the marriage was really a two-staged process. They would have what they call kiddushin, the betrothment or the engagement. And the couple was legally married at that point. They were legally married, but they didn't live together. There was a period of about a year where the man would get the house organized and set up and, I guess, get things ready. And then after that period of time, they would have what is called a nisuin, which was the actual marriage, and they would sleep together for the first time. And this story takes place within that year period. And Joseph comes home one day and he sees, you know, his fiance, as they say, great with child. And he doesn't assume that she's the mother of the Messiah. He doesn't realize this is a virgin birth. He assumes that she was cheating on him. So it's very clear that this whole idea of this being a sign, the virgin birth, as a useful sign, it's just absurd. I mean, it doesn't say in Isaiah, behold, the goldfish will conceive and bear a son. That would be supernatural, and that would be pretty amazing if that happened. You know, that's
what you've got that image in my head. I've got a goldfish.
I'm sorry. Anyway, I'm looking at a goldfish on your for your logo here. it must have been seeping into my brain.
Oh, the poor goldfish. Anyway, continue.
So another thing that's very interesting, by the way, is that in the Gospels, there are stories where the Jewish opponents of Jesus, or maybe not opponents, just people who were sincere, they ask him for a sign. How do we know that you're the Messiah? And Jesus doesn't offer the virgin birth as a sign. Meaning here, Isaiah says that God's going to give you a sign. Behold, this woman's going to give birth. And so when Jesus is asked for a sign specifically in the book of Mark chapter 8, he says no sign will be given to this generation. Now, he simply could have said, God provided you a sign. It was a sign of this my miraculous birth to a virgin. In Matthew, it changes. In Matthew 12, he says only one sign will be given. But he doesn't give the sign of the virgin birth. He gives a sign of Jonah. So the claim that's being made here that this is a clear prophecy from the Jewish scriptures that identifies the Messiah is very problematic. And what I'd like to do, just because time is precious to us, is just point out the two basic problems with the New Testament reading of Isaiah here. The two problems really are one of context and one of translation. I often ask Christians who quotes Isaiah 7:14. It's almost like it comes off the tongue very simply, quickly. Mm. I asked them, do they know what's going on in the beginning of the chapter? What is chapter 7 of Isaiah talking about? What's the context? And I've rarely met any Christian who knows what's going on in this chapter. And it's obvious that you can't really understand verse 14 plucked out of the rest of the chapter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, reading the chapter at the beginning, you see that it's describing a very acute and serious crisis that was being faced by the southern kingdom of Judah. We know that after the reign of Solomon, the 12 tribes split into basically two different kingdoms. There mm-hmm. was the northern kingdom called Israel or Ephraim, basically the 10 tribes. Mm-hmm. And there were the two southern tribes of Judah and Benjamin that were referred to the kingdom of Judah. And the king of the south was called Ahaz. And what this chapter describes is his basically being very, very concerned because the northern kingdom, which were the 10 northern tribes, entered into an alliance with Syria. And these two superpowers, the 10 northern tribes and Syria, were planning on coming down and just wiping him out. Mm-hmm. So they're terrified. And that's really the context of this chapter. And God is basically assuring him that he doesn't have to worry. And he doesn't seem to necessarily buy the assurances. So God finally says, look, I'm going to give you a sign. And God says to him, what is the sign going to be? He says it's going to be this young woman who's with child, who is pregnant. So there was a woman, this is taking place 700 years approximately before the first century. Mm-hmm. There's a woman back then who is with child, who will give birth, and the child's name will be called Emmanuel. Mm-hmm. And we're told that this child is going to have a diet of honey and yogurt or whatever he's going to eat, curds and honey. But the prophet says that before this child is able to distinguish between good and evil, these two kingdoms, these two nations that are vexing you, that are threatening you, will basically come to an end. That's the story here. And the story is very clear. It's very straightforward. It's quite, it's not ambiguous. We see here a political military crisis that was facing the southern kingdom of Judah 700 years before the Common Era. And they're given a sign that God will be with them, they're not mm-hmm. going to be abandoned, and that these two terrible enemies that are seeking their destruction will be destroyed within a very short period of time, meaning that there's a child. It's not clear, is it the child of the prophet or is it the child of the king? But it's interesting that it speaks about a woman that they know, meaning that the Hebrew word here is with a definite article. It's Ha-Alma, the young woman. In Hebrew, it's called the Hey Hayidiyah, the Hey of knowledge, because we know who it is. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if these two men, Ahaz and Isaiah, didn't know who the young woman was, it would be a useless sign. I mean, if it's talking sure. about some girl in France that's going to give birth,
right.
so they don't know what's happening. But it's a woman that they are familiar with. It's either the prophet's wife or the king's wife. And we're told that before this kid can tell good from evil, I don't know, have that 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, the two powers that are threatening them will be destroyed. And it's interesting that in Second Kings chapters 15 and 16, this prophecy is fulfilled. We see that basically the destruction of both Syria and the 10 northern tribes disappear. So the context is clear here. It's unambiguous to the point, by the way, where in the Middle Ages, famous Christian scholar Andrew of St. Victor got into a lot of trouble because he essentially said that this chapter in Isaiah has nothing to do with the birth of Jesus. He said it has to do with this political crisis facing the kingdom of Judah 700 years before Jesus. And dozens of Christian commentaries essentially take the same point of view. The Harper's Bible Dictionary, the New Interpreter's Bible, they all say that this chapter in Isaiah is not a prophecy about the Messiah. It is describing a political military crisis that took place hundreds of years before Jesus. It's obvious that the birth of Jesus 700 years later would hardly be a reassurance to King Ahaz or the kingdom of Judah.
So let me just ask you a question there. For such commentaries to make that claim, I mean, the New King James has done it in a very safe way. It said, here are the three views. You know, this is a prophecy that's somewhat problematic, can be complicated to understand, and here are just the three views, and yeah, you make up your mind. What you're saying is that there is a number of Christian commentaries that say, oh, come on, guys, really, this is very, very clear what Isaiah chapter 7 is talking about and has nothing to do with the birth of Jesus. Now, in doing so, they really are—they're really saying that the claims of the writer of Matthew are false. Really,
I think
that's what they're saying. Right? You don't think so? Okay.
No, I think that what they would say is that Matthew is not really giving you a real interpretation of what Isaiah is talking about. I think that it would be perfectly legitimate for a Christian believer to say, look, there's no real connection between the chapter in Isaiah and the birth of Jesus. But we see a connection in the sense that, you know, there's a birth of a child, and there's going to be some great, you know, salvation which comes as a result of this child's birth. And, you know, I would say it's a very poetic, allegorical, symbolic spin on Isaiah. And I think it's possible to admit that on the level of just simply understanding what Isaiah is speaking about, you could say, as a Christian, has nothing to do with the story of Jesus, that Isaiah didn't mean or imply or intend to be describing the virgin birth of any child 700 years later. Mm-hmm. But I think that a person has the right to say that they see some kind of literary connection between the stories.
A literary connection, sure, because we've seen literary connections. I mean, this list that we're going through is primarily literary connections, whether it be in phrase, in word, or in theme. However, it's a very difficult position to hold from a Christian perspective because, as I've already read, Matthew chapter 1, verse 22, it says, so all this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. I mean, just to say that this was fulfilled to fulfill what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, and then quotes specifically from Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14.
So I think if I had to play the Christian here,
sure, go ahead.
That what it's really saying, I mean, look, if I didn't want to be generous, I would say that Matthew was just off his rocker and he was just, you know, he was totally, you know, what he's citing here just has absolutely zero legitimacy.
Either he was, I think it'd be fair for someone to come to the conclusion that the writer of Matthew was either ignorant of Isaiah chapter 7 or was relying on the ignorance of his readers.
Or, I think, to be generous, I would say that the writer does see, from their perspective, meaning from their subjective allegorical, symbolic perspective, they see, right? It's meaningful to them, a connection between the stories. They see that on some level, again, it's in their mind, from their perspective as believers in Jesus, they see that this story of Isaiah is fulfilled, meaning that it comes to its completion in the story of the gospel. But again, what's important to remember is that interpretation only becomes credible if you begin with the conclusion first, meaning you have to begin with your belief that Jesus is the Messiah who's born to a virgin. Once you believe that, if you start off with the belief that Jesus is the Messiah born to a virgin, you could go back to the Jewish scriptures and say, well, where might that be alluded to? Where can you find some hint to that? Where do you find some allusion to that? Or, as Carmen might say, a connection. And I think that, again, if I'm trying to be generous, I don't want to, you know, assume the worst for Matthew, but that I don't think he's trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes necessarily.
Okay.
But I think that as someone who is a believer in Jesus, and someone who probably is convinced that every truth that he has to be somehow alluded to or found in the Jewish scriptures, this seems to be for him a meaningful hook. This is where he wants to.
So this in Christian theology, this is known as sensus plenior, I think is the way you pronounce it. It's the Latin for the fuller sense or the fuller completion of such a connection or the fuller fulfillment of a prophecy.
Well, I think many contemporary Christians speak about this idea of dual prophecy. Mm. That, you know, they speak about the idea that you know, obviously they concur, they agree that when you read chapter 7 of Isaiah, it's talking about a particular historical event 700 years before the Common Era. But they will say that it also has a prophetic fulfillment 700 years later with the birth of Jesus.
Sorry to interrupt you, but it just occurred to me. I mean, so you're right, dual fulfillment is another way that you can describe this. There's nothing to stop an individual from having another private revelation, getting a following of that revelation, very charismatic person, writes letters and books and gets his religion up and going, and then begins relying, of course, on the Tanakh and on the New Testament, and then his writings as well, and then invents another theological discipline called not dual prophecy, but what would we say?
Tertiary.
Maybe thank you.
Tertiary.
Tertiary prophecy. Wow. Okay.
You know, it's funny. I have on my bookshelf something that Mormons call a triple Bible. I should call it a triple Bible. And it's
because I had them in mind when I was saying this.
Yeah, I have. It's a very, very thick. I mean, you can't even get your hands around it. It's the Old Testament. Then there's the New Testament. Then there's the Book of Mormon and there's Pearl of Great Price and Doctrines and Covenants. And you know, they're sort of an illustration of what you're just saying, that once the New Testament is able to come along and piggyback on the Old Testament and say, look, we have another level of fulfillment of the scriptures in the Hebrew Bible.
Mm.
You're right. Nothing is to stop, you know, Joseph Smith and whoever else is going to come after that and say, well, and we have a third level or a fourth level. I often say this to my students. I say a text that can mean anything means nothing. That once you're able to, with total fluidity, spin a verse in ways which have nothing to do with the original context, then, again, everyone has a right to do it, but it leaves you open to the same process. People can do that once you start that process. And also, you don't really have the ability to go back and say, and I have a good reason to believe that this was the intention of the original author. Meaning that I would say that to assert that Isaiah chapter 7 has a dual fulfillment, you'd have to find some reason in the text, meaning there'd have to be something in the text of Isaiah to tell you that you need to read this as one prophecy that will be fulfilled many, many, many hundreds of years later. Mm-hmm. I think just to invent this idea that the prophecy has dual fulfillment is very dangerous because it makes scripture meaningless. A second problem that most Christians don't think of when they propose this idea of a dual fulfillment, I mean, I've asked this to many Christians. I would say, mm-hmm. well, then do you believe that there was a virgin birth during the time of Ahaz? You know, for Christians, the virgin birth is very critical because it ties into the deity of Jesus. And the idea that his virgin birth was not unique and there was a prior virgin birth 700 years earlier is very, very difficult. And if they're insisting that that's what's happening in this passage, that's exactly what they have to accept, that there were two virgin births.
And yet what the understanding generally, well, as you said, most Christians don't understand the context of Isaiah chapter 7, so it doesn't enter their mind as to what it meant in the day. But for those who do, they will accept that the Alma, spoken of in 7 verse 14, is a young woman. Whereas when we get to Matthew chapter 1, verse 22, 23, it's a virgin. Can you just remind the listeners the difference between Alma and Betula?
That's the second. I mentioned there were two problems with Matthew's reading of Isaiah. One was context, and the second was translation. So I just wanted to make one more point that this idea of dual prophecy, you know, again, it's problematic for so many reasons, but one of the problems is that when you read Isaiah chapter 7, it speaks about these two dreaded kingdoms that would be destroyed after the birth of this child. You don't see any of that in the story of Matthew or Luke, meaning that it requires to have this dual prophecy. It requires literally surgically removing just a few words from the chapter here and then applying it to something that happens 700 years later. There's no way of actually reading the story where the story itself has any kind of there's any fidelity to the story in Isaiah and showing that it all that stuff really happened hundreds of years later. It's what I would call a interpretive rationalization or a grasping at straws to justify this idea of a dual prophecy. Now, when it comes to translation, I mean, this is I think one of the great weaknesses of Matthew. It's it's just a classical, really, a mistranslation. The Hebrew, and there's no disputing what the Hebrew says, it's Alma. And Alma simply means, you ask any school kid in Israel today, it means a young woman. It does not mean a virgin. Alma is basically the feminine form. In Hebrew, there are masculine and feminine nouns. So Alma is the feminine form of the Hebrew Elem. And Elem is always translated, even in every King James Bible. It comes up several times in the Old Testament. Elem is always translated as a young man, and it's never translated as a young virginal male. It has nothing to do with virginity. Alma simply refers to a person's youthfulness, their age, and it has no reference whatsoever to their sexual experience.
Right.
Now, it's interesting that a particular Alma might indeed be a virgin. I mean, Christians often argue that, young women were usually virgins. Now, back then, people did get married earlier than they do today. But, you could be a young woman at 12, you could be a young woman at 16, you could be a young woman at 18. But the argument is often made that when you go through the Hebrew Bible, the Almas, so to speak, these young women, were all virgins. It's not always the case. We know there are times when the word Alma is used, and it doesn't mean a virgin. But it's important to understand the faulty logic here, because if you go through the stories in the Bible, a particular Alma might be a virgin because she has not slept with any men, but she might also be a short brunette. And it wouldn't mean then that you translate Alma as a short brunette virgin.
Sure.
The word maintains its authenticity. The word Alma simply means a young woman, whether she's tall or short, whether she's blonde or brunette, whether she's a virgin or non-virgin. It simply means a young woman. And there is a particular word in Hebrew in the Bible for a virgin. Whenever the Bible is actually concerned contextually with letting you know someone's sexual experience, it uses the Hebrew word betulah. So we have many, many examples in the Hebrew Bible where we're interested not in the age of someone, but in their sexual experience, and we have a Hebrew word for that. And to me, the clearest indication that this is is that if we were to put together a list today of Christian translations of the Hebrew scriptures that have simply corrected this mistranslation, I think I once came up with a list of about 20 modern Christian translations of the Bible that agree that the word Alma simply does not mean virgin, it means a young woman. It's also important to remember that even if you mistranslate this word in Isaiah as virgin, even if you were to mistranslate it as virgin, the text doesn't indicate that she would remain a virgin after giving birth. Meaning, every day of the year today, right, there are virgins who become pregnant and they give birth. That's very routine. But afterwards, they're no longer a virgin. So if Isaiah here is speaking about a virgin who will conceive and bear a son, that's not so unusual. Isaiah would not be telling you that after conceiving and bearing a son, she would still be a virgin. So even if you mistranslate the word, which you shouldn't do. Now, one of the things that Christians will claim, this is a common claim, is that when the rabbis translated Isaiah into the Greek, call it the Targum Shivim, the Septuagint, they rendered the word as Parthenos, and they say that that word clearly means a virgin, and therefore they say you shouldn't blame Matthew, or the King James at least, for rendering this as virgin. That's what the rabbis themselves translated. So the truth of the matter is that the origin of this translation of the Bible into Greek is not as clear as Christians often assume it is. The rabbis only translated the five books of Moses, and the rest of the Bible was not part of their project. And we know that the preserving and transmitting of the Greek translation was really done thoroughly through the church. And one of the reasons we know this is because the Talmud, which speaks about the rabbinic translation of the five books of Moses, shows you there were about 10 places where the rabbis altered the translation of the text to basically eliminate the possibility of misinterpreting it. And if you compare what the Talmud says was done 2,000 years ago to the Christian versions today of the Septuagint, they don't at all line up. So it's very clear that whatever the rabbis did was not maintained and preserved by the church. But it's not true that in ancient Greek the word Parthenos meant a virgin. It could have been, it's almost very interestingly like the word Alma. It could either refer to a virgin or a non-virgin. It was always referring to a young woman. But we have stories in the Bible, for example, in Genesis 34, where Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, is raped. And the Greek translation refers to her as a Parthenos, as a Parthenos after she's raped.
After she's raped, right. Okay, so she's no longer a virgin, obviously.
You would think not.
Let me just repeat some of that back to you to make sure I understand. My understanding is that the original Septuagint consisted only of the first five books, the Torah. Later, and I mean much later, the rest of the books of the Tanakh were added to the Septuagint. Nevertheless, what you're saying is that the writer of Matthew obviously relied on a Greek translation, wherever it came from, a Greek translation of Isaiah. And even though the word that is used there, Parthenos, even though that word can be used for a young woman or a virgin, he certainly leaned towards the understanding of a virgin. Therefore, it's not entirely his fault. Is this where you're going?
Yes. And it's interesting, by the way, that I long ago purchased a English version. I have to be careful I don't say English virgin. An English version, a translation of the Septuagint into English. And it's a Christian edition. It's done by Christian scholars. And in their introduction to this translation, the Greek translation, they say something interesting. They say that the quality of the translations is very, very different between the books of the Bible. They say that the quality of the translation from Hebrew into Greek in the five books of Moses is the most accurate by far, and they say that the quality of the translation in the book of Isaiah is by far the least accurate and the worst quality translation.
Oh, truly. Wow.
So the point is that I think, speaking, you know, as a rabbi, what I want to emphasize is that, you know, God did not reveal the Septuagint to us at Mount Sinai, and the prophets didn't speak in Greek, and so, you know, for Jews, you know, we would feel comfortable if people are quoting from the Hebrew Scriptures, and you're not going to score points with us by basing an argument upon a translation of the Scriptures into Greek or any other language. Again, Jews today don't study the New English Bible or the Living Bible. We study the Bible in Hebrew because that's the only place you're going to get really an accurate sense of the language of Revelation. To be forced to base the Gospels upon a translation of the Hebrew is just, for us, doesn't get off the starting gate if you're forced to rely on that. Because where's the authority? Where does the authority of that translation supersede what the Hebrew says? So it wouldn't be an impressive argument to say that Matthew is basing himself upon the Greek translation. But even if they advance that argument, the Greek translation itself does not necessarily mean a virgin.
Now, Emmanuel, It's a bit funny to have to even bring this one up, isn't it? Because I guess as my my study notes on my New King James tried to explain, Emmanuel, it says, I'll just repeat it, it says, at this time of the year, during the Christmas season, this verse becomes part of our common vocabulary. Most Christian pageants recite this verse and pastors explain the meaning of Emmanuel. But what it says is that the child will be called Emmanuel. Now, in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, it's referring to the name of the kid, right?
Yes, and it's important to understand that God with us is really a mistranslation. It's almost always what you'll find in a Christian translation of Isaiah, but it's really it's a very, very poor translation of the Hebrew. In Hebrew, the verb form to be is simply understood, and so you'd actually accurately render this as God is with us. You would never translate Emmanuel as God with us. The translation would be really God is with us. And you know, I think this commentary that you brought up by the New King James version here points out that this is not a name that Jesus was ever given. And he's never referred to as Emmanuel in the entire New Testament. The idea of God with us, God is with us, really fits into the context of the chapter, meaning the whole theme of the chapter is the sense of abandonment and terror that is being felt by the southern kingdom and King Ahaz. And so the name of this child is very significant. God is basically saying, I'm going to give you a sign to reassure you that you shouldn't be afraid. Why shouldn't you be afraid? Because, first of all, this kid is, in terms of time, going to show you sequentially or time-wise, there's not a lot of time until these two kingdoms are going to be gone. So you could rest assured that within a few years, these people are going to be toast. But the name of the child itself is significant because God is with us. God is not abandoning us. God is with us.
And it's reminiscent of books like Hosea, where the prophet, again, has children and they have names that are significant that relate to prophecy, right?
All the time. Throughout the Bible, names are always used. I mean, even in Isaiah chapter 8, he has children. His names are significant. Another thing that's very, very important, I think it confuses many Christians, because this is really how they're spinning this name. To them, the name here isn't just a name. To them, this name indicates that this child will be God in the flesh, because the way they mistranslate it is God with us. So they see Isaiah as saying that this child will be God with us, God on earth, God
coming. God in the flesh, yeah.
And so the name for them is proof something. The name here proves that this child will be divine. Now, it's really strange that the Christian reader doesn't really appreciate usually that in the Hebrew Bible, probably the majority of names are names that are divine names. I mean, if you go through the names of the characters in the Hebrew Scriptures, everybody's name contains God in it. You know, God here.
Mine does.
What's that?
My name is Jonathan. Yehonatan, which means a gift given by God. Yeah,
you're a gift of God.
That's what I am. That's what I tell my wife all the time.
I can't lay claim to that. My name just means he will laugh, Yitzchak. But my English name, Michael, right? Michael, he who is like God. Only my mother thinks that I'm God. No one else thinks that I'm God. So every Hebrew name, Yehuda and Daniel and Eli and Elihu and Yeshayahu, Yecheskel, and you go through, make a list of all the names in the Bible, they're virtually all divine names because they're not saying that the bearer of the name is God. I mean, think about how many Jewish people today are named Emmanuel. No one's going to assume that any of them is God in the flesh. So it's just sort of, it's for Hebrew speakers, it's almost comical for people to read Isaiah chapter 7 here and really seriously think that Isaiah is telling you that this child is going to be God. Why? Because his name is Emmanuel. It's really absurd.
No, I'm just going to say it's even more complicated, though, for the Christian, isn't it? Because it ceases to be a personal name when you get to Matthew. It's no longer the actual name of an individual. It's now a title. Is that fair?
I think so, yes.
Because clearly, I mean, it seems very clear because Matthew, or the writer of Matthew, quotes from Isaiah and says, behold, you know, they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated God with us. Verse 25 says, she brought forth the son and called his name Jesus. And you think to yourself, well, dude, come on. I mean, didn't you listen to the angel? Snap out of it. The angel said that the kid's going to be called Emmanuel.
And by the way, some homework for the reader or the listeners. I keep on saying readers. For our listeners. Is to really look carefully at how Matthew quotes Isaiah, because aside from the mistranslation of the word Alma as virgin, he really does a few sneaky things when he cites this verse in Isaiah. For example, I mentioned before that in Hebrew, in Isaiah, it's speaking about a woman that both Isaiah and the king, Ahaz, know, because it uses the definite article, Ha Alma, the young woman, or let's say even the virgin. But when Matthew quotes it, he takes away the definite article.
Yeah.
He removes it. It's now a virgin. Because again, you know, if the Hebrew identifies this woman as someone known to both Ahaz and Isaiah, it would eliminate someone that's living 700 years later. So Matthew's forced to make the Hebrew less precise and more vague in order to open up the possibility that it's speaking about someone else. And then later, Matthew changes in the same verse, who's going to name the child? You see, in Isaiah, she, this woman who's going to give birth to the child, and she will name him Emmanuel.
Very good point, yes.
In Matthew, it's they will name
they. Him. Yes, that's right.
So what Matthew is doing is, in order to allow for this, you know, amplification, if you will, you know, of what Isaiah is actually saying, it really only gets off the ground when there's a manipulation of the text itself to allow for this amplification. I just wanted to say one more thing about Emmanuel, by the way, is indicating divinity. That, you know, if it's really true, if that's the clear meaning of Emmanuel, if a child named Emmanuel, especially this child that Matthew's talking about, you know, if this name really does indicate divinity, that this child is named Emmanuel because this child is God who is with us, what is peculiar is that none of the people in the Gospels seem to have gotten this message, because when you read the story of Jesus growing up, it's very clear that his parents, his siblings, no one related to him as if he was God in the flesh. You know, he says things that puzzle them and they think he's out of his mind. You know, he speaks about having to be doing the business of his father when he gets lost in Jerusalem. What in the world is he talking about? Meaning that if it was clear to them when they fulfilled this prophecy of naming this divine child Emmanuel, that they were naming this kid Emmanuel because he is God with us, and that means he is God in the flesh, they clearly didn't understand that he was a divine child, because you don't see any stories in the Gospels where his family, who would have been the ones to have been most aware of his name and you know, his process of his birth, no one seems to be clued into the fact that this Emmanuel child is really God in the flesh. It's hard to square.
We have done one whole program on Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. I think we've done really well. That is number 113 and 114 on the New Revised Standard list, thanks to Carmen Welker of therefinersfire.org. Thank you, Carmen, for saving us some time there. We're going to be continuing next week and continuing on through the list. This is our Christmas special. You also have a Christmas special. What do you guys do every Christmas Day?
So we, for the past, 15, 20 years, have always had a special program on the 24th of December and the 25th. Primarily, not that we're Christmas observers, but, you know, in many cities in North America, in the Jewish community, not much is going on. You know, a lot of places are closed and people have very little to do. So for us, it was always an appropriate time to have a special seminar educational program. So this year, we're going to be running a number of special programs for the Jewish community here in Toronto, but of course they will be filmed and then put up on our YouTube channel. We're going to be doing a program on the 24th of December, which will be a Jewish critique of the New Testament. It'll be basically a Jewish understanding of the New Testament, and specifically why it is not accepted as scripture by Judaism. Mm-hmm. So that'll be on the 24th of December. The same evening, we're going to be actually having a special program for the more, what sometimes in the press are called, ultra-Orthodox Jews of Toronto, mm-hmm. Discussing a new development in the world of Christian missionaries who are trying to infiltrate the Orthodox community. And then we'll be doing a full-day seminar on the 25th of December, a three-part seminar that will be with a wonderful scholar, Rabbi Israel Chaim Blumenthal from Lakewood, New Jersey.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
yes.
Okay.
He'll be coming up here to do a three-part seminar, really exploring the attempts by Christian missionaries to co-opt and exploit rabbinic literature. That means to try and make the claim that not only does the Tanakh support Christian beliefs and theology, but their claim that the Talmud, the Midrash, the Zohar, etc., that these texts also point to and substantiate Christian doctrine. So that will be a special all-day seminar on the 25th of December.
That will be fascinating. So people in the area, you can go and can people register to be there? How do they?
I'm not sure we've actually even posted this online yet, but in the next few days it's going to be on our website, on our Facebook page, on our Twitter page, in the Excellent. Ether, on the cloud. And people will be able to find out the exact details of where, when, how.
In the coming days.
Yes.
By the time this is published, it'll probably be there. And the website, of course, is jewsforjudaism.ca, jewsforjudaism.ca. Nevertheless, if you're not in the Toronto area, that's okay, because it will be uploaded sometime after that, and you'll be able to, if that's of interest to you, you can certainly listen to it in the coming weeks or days when it's made available. So there we have it. Now, I think... Oh, before we go, you told me a story. You were walking to somebody's house on last Shabbat. What happened?
This was very strange. At least for me, it was strange. I guess, I live in what you could call a very traditional Orthodox community here in Toronto. If you were to go on the streets around where I live, you'll see on a Shabbat afternoon or morning, you'll see hundreds of people walking in typical Orthodox attire with black hats and black suits and the beards, except for the women. They don't have the beards.
No, but, that's right.
But I was walking with my wife to visit with some friends for Shabbat lunch. We had about a 25-minute walk. And I passed this couple who apparently the fellow knew who I was, but I didn't really recognize him. And he stops me and his eyes lit up, and he just tells me that he's been enjoying so much listening to these programs with Jono and exploring these prophecies. And I was flabbergasted. I just couldn't imagine that this fellow knows about this show, listens to it. I was very, very surprised, pleasantly surprised.
Write in and leave a message in the comments. If you've been listening, you've been enjoying it, then good on you, my friend, for letting us know that you've been enjoying it. It's a wonderful blessing to know. And how about that, being stopped in the street and saying, hey, I love the series. That's a great thing. So there it is, my friends. We are going to be continuing next week. Rabbi Michael Skobeck of Jews for Judaism Canada, jewsforjudaism.ca. Thank you so much, my friend, and I look forward to speaking to you very soon.
My great pleasure.
In the meantime, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.